The topic of today's conference is water quality in general. And, you know, if anybody who's been around the Minnesota Groundwater Association for some time knows that this is probably the topic that we've covered the most at conferences. It's been, but most of you probably deal with water quality, groundwater quality in particular, in some way as part of your jobs. It's a very broad topic. We tried to narrow it somewhat by limiting it to some of the issues that our people are dealing with these days, in particular some of the non-point water quality issues that affect groundwater, and some of the ambient issues. And we also wanted to try to give a little bit of a sense of you know, what kind of geochemical characteristics are important to consider and to monitor when you're studying these issues. So our very first speaker today is Pete McMahon from the U.S. Geological Survey, and he's going to talk to us on characterizing redox conditions in groundwater, approaches and examples. So we're excited to have Pete here from Denver, and I don't see him right now. Oh, there he is. Okay.
I'd like to start by thanking you, Steve, for inviting me to join you guys this morning. I've been looking forward to it. As Steve mentioned, I'm going to talk about characterizing redox conditions in groundwater before I forget. So in my talk today, I'm going to touch on four different topics. First, I'd like to talk about why redox processes in groundwater are important. I'd like to touch on redox concepts in groundwater systems. And excuse me. Then I'm going to present two different frameworks for distinguishing redox processes in groundwater. And then finally, show some examples of applying redox frameworks in groundwater studies. Okay, well, why are redox processes in groundwater important? And this may be preaching to the choir, but I think it's important for us just to revisit these ideas nevertheless. Well, redox can mobilize or immobilize natural contaminants such as metals and radionuclides. Redox can contribute to the degradation or preservation of anthropogenic contaminants like nitrate and VOCs. Redox can generate undesirable byproducts like dissolved ferrous iron or hydrogen sulfide or methane. And redox can even create or destroy porosity in aquifer sediments. So there are chemical and physical reasons why it's useful to study redox processes in groundwater systems. Okay, well, many of the important redox processes are microbially mediated at the near neutral pH and low temperature of most groundwater systems. And the reason that these redox reactions even occur in groundwater systems is that the flow of electrons from donors to acceptors is capable of doing work, and microorganisms, just like us, use that work to sustain their life functions. We're eating juice and yogurt and bagels this morning. They like organic carbon too. So there's energy to be gained, and microorganisms tap into that energy. The most common electron donors in groundwater systems are usually reduced forms of organic carbon, although reduced forms of nitrogen, sulfur and iron can also be used as electron donors in groundwater systems. In natural systems, the most common electron acceptors are things like dissolved oxygen, nitrate, sulfate, and CO2, as well as oxidized forms of manganese and iron in the solid phase. In contaminated systems, you can also have things like PCE and TCE acting as electron acceptors. The sequence through which these electron acceptors are consumed is entirely predictable based on the energy to be gained from the reactions. And so the most energetically favorable reactions will occur first, and in this case that would be oxygen reduction. So oxygen reduction, the most energetically favorable redox reaction, and then the least favorable redox, least energetically favorable redox reactions occur last. So in this case, carbon dioxide reduction to methane. of course, these redox reactions produce a number of end products like carbon dioxide, nitrogen gas, reduced forms of manganese and iron, hydrogen sulfide, methane. Normally, when we think of redox processes, we think about consumption of electron acceptors and production of these end products. But there are also intermediate products in redox reactions that are important. And perhaps one of the most important intermediate products is hydrogen gas. Hydrogen gas is produced during the fermentation of complex organic matter, and it's consumed during respiration. And each of these anaerobic redox processes that are shown on the screen has a characteristic steady state range of hydrogen concentrations. And that information and that fact can be used to help us distinguish redox processes in groundwater. And so this plot shows the steady state hydrogen concentrations for some of the more common anoxic redox processes. And those steady state concentrations range from less than 0.1 nanomolar for denitrification to greater than 5 nanomolar for methanogenesis. So ideally, to characterize redox processes in groundwater, we like to take into consideration the spatial and temporal patterns of electron acceptor consumption, intermediate product concentrations, and the spatial and temporal patterns of end product production. I'd like to take into consideration all of those things to help us sort out what are the redox processes going on in groundwater. And to my knowledge, the first framework that tried to incorporate all these concepts, the first redox framework that tried to incorporate all these concepts was the one published by Chappelle et al. In 1995. And so they took into consideration, consideration electron acceptor consumption shown on the left-hand side there. So, for example, do oxygen or nitrate or sulfate concentrations decrease in space or time? They take into consideration end product production along flow paths. So, for example, do concentrations of ferrous iron, hydrogen sulfide, or methane increase along flow paths? And it takes into consideration intermediate product or hydrogen concentrations. And this logic chart here, if you will, is just taken from that report, and it just asks a series of yes-no questions to help you come to a redox diagnosis for your sample or your flow system. Well, what happens if you don't have complete data, or you don't have data along flow paths, for example? You just have data for a single well. More recently, we've published a redox framework that's based on analyses for five of the more commonly measured redox parameters. So dissolved oxygen, nitrate, manganese, iron, and sulfate. And this framework isn't intended to replace the more robust framework that Chappelle et others published. Rather, it's just intended to provide an internally consistent approach for assessing redox conditions when you don't have more complete data. I'm not going to go into great detail in this chart, but I do want to point out that on the left-hand side, there are four redox categories. There's oxic, suboxic, anoxic, and mixed. The difference between suboxic and anoxic, they both apply to systems with DO concentrations less than half a milligram per liter. But for suboxic, you also have low concentrations of nitrate, manganese, and iron, and so you can't really distinguish in more detail what the anaerobic redox process is. Whereas for the anoxic systems designations there, you can get into the weeds more in terms of what the specific anaerobic redox process is. So just for today's talk, keep in mind oxic, suboxic, anoxic, and mixed. Mixed just means that the criteria for more than one redox process is met. regardless of the redox framework that you are going to apply, it's really important to remember that mixing is a major complicating factor. You know, products from these redox reactions are mixed by flowing groundwater. And so I show an example here where you might have a sample that has no oxygen or nitrate, but has high iron and methane. Well, that sample has seen oxygen reduction, iron reduction, methanogenesis, and maybe other processes. So in practice, determining a unique redox process at a given well may not be possible because of the complex history of that sample. So it's kind of a buyer beware statement. Mixing is a real issue. Okay, so I want to get into now some applications of these redox frameworks in groundwater studies. And the first one is relating redox to water quality at the regional scale. This map shows locations of some 5,100 domestic wells that have chemical data for those five species that I mentioned, oxygen, nitrate, manganese, iron, and sulfate. And these are data from the USGS's National Water Quality Assessment Program. And there are data from 31 different major aquifers shown on this map, and the major aquifers are color-coded according to their general lithology. And so the idea was, well, can we use this framework to say something about the differences in water quality between these different hydrogeologic systems that represent a broad range of geologic, climatic, hydrologic conditions? So each of these 31 principal aquifers has a pie chart, and the pie chart just shows the distribution or the percentage of samples that were classified as being oxic, suboxic, anoxic, or mixed, so those four redox categories that I mentioned earlier. And for systems like the unconsolidated sands and gravels in the high plains, high plains or the basin and range or the Central Valley in California, those systems had predominantly oxic conditions. But if you look at the glaciated deposits in the upper Midwest or the Cambrian Ordovician in the upper Midwest or the Silurian Devonian carbonate aquifers in the upper Midwest, there are many more anoxic samples there. So there are some spatial differences in these redox conditions that appear to be related to things like geology and climate and so on. So this figure shows box plots of nitrate concentrations, and they're divided into the six major lithologic groups that were shown in that map earlier. And within each lithologic group, there's a box plot for samples that were characterized as being oxic, mixed, or anoxic, and oxic being in yellow, anoxic being in red. For each of these lithologic groups, nitrate concentrations were significantly higher in samples that were characterized as being oxic than nitrate concentrations that were characterized as being anoxic. Regardless of lithology and all the variability that is inherent in these 31 different principal aquifers, nitrate's always higher in oxic groundwater. This is a similar diagram, but now we're showing arsenic concentrations. And five of the six lithologic groups had data for each of the redox categories. Now, rather than the red showing just anoxic, it shows samples that were either manganese reducing or iron sulfate reducing. The Western Volcanics was the only group that didn't have data for the reduced conditions. In four of the five situations where we had data for all the redox categories, arsenic concentrations were significantly higher in the reduced waters than they were in the oxic waters. Again, even though we have all this inherent variability in these different principal aquifers. That's not to say that you can't get high arsenic in oxic waters. In fact, for the sand and gravel aquifers shown on the left there, when you break out the basin and range samples from those oxic samples, those actually had some of the highest arsenic concentrations anywhere in the country because of high pH and salinity mobilizing arsenic in those conditions. So You're masking a lot of local variability in this regional perspective. But nevertheless, there are trends apparent here, even though we have all this variability. And this plot shows VOC detection frequency for samples that were either oxic or anoxic for four different VOCs. For chloroform and tetrachloroethane on the left there, the highest detection frequencies were in the oxic samples. And this is consistent with what we know about chloroform and PCE degradation. They don't degrade under oxic conditions, but they do degrade by reductive dehalogenation under anaerobic conditions. And so it would follow that the degradation products of these reactions would be higher in anaerobic waters. And in fact, when you look at the dichloroethene isomers and vinyl chloride, you do see higher detection frequencies of those in anoxic water than you do in oxic water. And then methyl tert-butyl ether, which is a petroleum hydrocarbon, not a chlorinated solvent, that degrades more readily in oxic conditions than anoxic. And in fact, you see lower detection frequencies in oxic waters. So again, tons of variability in these 31 principal aquifers, yet these simple redox characterizations tell us something about the occurrence and distribution of these different contaminants, nitrate, arsenic, VOCs, in groundwater. And so one of the things we can learn from this simple analysis is highlighted in this bullet here, and that is that O2 measurements provide a reasonable but inexpensive first approximation of groundwater vulnerability to nitrate, arsenic, and VOC contamination in groundwater systems. So measuring O2 in the field should be a standard operating procedure, I think. And I say that just because Tim Cowdery and I were involved in pulling these kind of data from the USGS data repositories, and it's amazing how many samples didn't have DO data. Probably half the samples, maybe more, I can't remember exactly. Yeah, and so it seems logical, measure DO, but it isn't done as often as you think it would be. Okay, so my second example is just looking at the evolution of redox processes in two very different types of flow systems. This is up near the Otter Tail River here in Minnesota, and this is work that Tim and Larry Puckett published back in 2002. And it shows the distribution of redox conditions by these different colored zones, oxic O2 reduction in yellow down to sulfate reduction, methanogenesis in black. And two things I want you to note here is that, one, the stratification of redox conditions is vertical. There's vertical stratification of redox conditions. And the second thing is that the oxygen-reducing conditions are at the upgradient end of flow paths, and the methanogenic conditions are at the downgradient end. And so this kind of pattern is what you'd expect in a natural system with relatively high recharge and it being electron donor enriched. So there's organic carbon and pyrite and things like that in this system. Contrast that with a system that's contaminated, in this case by gasoline that was spilled in about 1990. This was work done in South Carolina by Chappelle and others. And by 1994, the system was essentially oxygen reducing and iron reducing. And by 1998, it had developed also sulfate reducing and methanogenic zones. And so the two points I made in the other example, turn on your head here. Now, redox, rather than being stratified vertically, is stratified laterally. And at the upgradient end of the flow path, you have methanogenic conditions rather than oxic conditions. And at the downgradient end, you have oxygen-reducing conditions rather than methanogenic conditions. So the evolution of redox processes in natural and contaminated systems can be very different from each other. My third example talks about redox controls on nitrate loading and transport in aquifers. And this plot shows median dissolved oxygen concentrations on the left, on the y-axis, excuse me, and median annual nitrogen input from fertilizer and manure
within a 500-meter buffer around wells on the x-axis. Each of these points represents a network of approximately 30 water table wells in an agricultural area. So there are a lot of data in this figure. I'm showing medians for those networks of wells. The symbols that are blue indicate median nitrate concentrations less than or equal to 1, and the networks shown in red indicate median nitrate concentrations greater than or equal to 10. And you can see that you get high nitrate in recharge in oxic systems that have a lot of nitrogen loading at the land surface. You have low median nitrate concentrations where you have either low nitrogen loading at the land surface or anaerobic conditions at the water table. And so I would just point out the two sites from the Central Valley in the San Joaquin. The two sites had similar nitrogen loading, but the San Joaquin system is oxic and has high median nitrate. The system in the Sacramento Valley is anoxic and has low nitrate. Redox has important consequences for actually loading of nitrate at the water table. Well, once you get nitrate in the water table, you know, what happens at that point? And again, that depends on things like redox and recharge and so forth. You saw this slide earlier for the Ottertail River system, and the nitrate-reducing sediments shown in the gray shading occur just a few meters really below the water table and appear to develop within the course of 10 years or so. Contrast that with this system from the High Plains in Kansas. Now you're looking at an aquifer that's a couple hundred meters thick, and the system is essentially oxic throughout, even though at the base of this aquifer, apparent groundwater ages are more than 10,000 years old. So here, nitrate is persisting for literally thousands of years, whereas in the Ottertail, it doesn't last more than a few years. So you can take this kind of age and redox information and say something about the persistence of nitrate in different flow systems. And so this graph on the left shows denitrification reaction progress, which is defined in the lower right there, versus apparent, and then apparent groundwater age is shown on the x-axis. And so you look at systems like a glacial aquifer near Princeton, Minnesota, shaded in black there, or a surficial aquifer in the South Carolina coastal plain, shaded in green. And in those situations, denitrification starts soon after recharge, and all of the nitrate is removed, so denitrification reaction progress equal to 1. All the nitrates removed within a few decades. In the Central Valley near Modesto, you have lag times of several decades, and that's indicated in this blue, lag times of several decades before denitrification even starts. And then even after 50 years, you've only removed about 20% of the nitrate. And then at the far extreme, you have systems like the High Plains in Kansas and the Rio Grande Aquifer System near Albuquerque, where denitrification lag times are thousands of years. So denitrification, the persistence of nitrate, is dependent on things like recharge rate, availability of electron donor, lots of different things. But there are ways to sort that out and compare different systems and look for nitrate vulnerability differences in different systems. Okay, my final example is actually three different ones. Steve, holler if I'm... my final example, I'm going to look at three different things, that how redox can help us actually understand something about the flow system, not just chemistry. And so this is, on the left, I'm showing a cross-section through the High Plains Aquifer near York, Nebraska. And at that site, there's an oxic nitrate-contaminated water table aquifer overlying an anoxic low nitrate confined sand. The two are separated by this confining layer here. And there's a public supply well that's screened in the confined sand. And if you measure nitrate in that well, you'll see that nitrate concentrations are very low, indicated over on this plot in red. This plot shows concentration of nitrogen either as nitrate or N2 from denitrification. And this sample on the left is
for the composite sample from the wellhead. These other samples are depth-dependent samples that were collected within the well screen of the public supply well. And you can see that nitrate concentrations are low, but if you had measured the N2 from denitrification and added that back to the nitrate that you measured, you can see that water making its way to this public supply well was actually recharged with some very high nitrate concentrations. Just because this well is in a confined sand doesn't necessarily mean it wasn't receiving recent recharge with high nitrate concentrations. And groundwater flow models for this area showed that the youngest water entering the confined sand through the confining layer was 60 years. So the youngest water was 60 years old. How are we getting this nitrate down there? Well, it turned out that there were numerous irrigation wells in the areas with long well screens that penetrated the confining layer. And those well screens were a conduit for the recent recharge with high nitrate to get down into the confined aquifer. Luckily, the confined aquifer had enough reducing potential to reduce most of that nitrate to N2 gas. But you can see here how looking at redox chemistry helped us kind of focus in on this flow process. This is an example from from a jet fuel contaminated aquifer in South Carolina, work that Don Verbleski and Frank Chappelle did. So each of these graphs is the same thing. It shows hydrogen concentration on the y-axis versus time on the x-axis. And the methanogenic and sulfate reducing regions of these based on hydrogen concentrations are indicated on the graph. So methane where there's high hydrogen, sulfate where there's lower hydrogen. And focusing first on the example on the left, it shows two different nested wells. And it shows that water from these wells shifted from being methanogenic to sulfate reducing in the shallow well over the course of about 10 days and in the deeper well over the course of about 3 months. And it turned out that that shift in redox processes was the result of a recharge event that introduced sulfate into the system. So there was no sulfate in the system. It was methanogenic. This recharge event occurred, introduced sulfate, shifted the redox from being methanogenic to sulfate reducing. It occurred quickly at the water table, but there was a lag time before that recharge made it deeper into the aquifer. And the example looking at redox helping us understand vertical flow. On the right is an example of redox helping us understand lateral or horizontal flow. Here, the shallow well remained sulfate reducing throughout the period of measurement, but the deeper well shifted from being sulfate reducing to methanogenic. And that happened because there was lateral inflow of BTEX, which is an electron donor, that allowed the system to consume the sulfate that was there and shift the system to being methanogenic. So here's an example of redox, measurement of redox processes, helping us sort out lateral flow processes. And then my final example is one that has to do with the occurrence of methane in the Wasatch Formation in western Colorado along the I-70 corridor. This is an area where there's a lot of gas development going on. These maps show the distributions of methane and dissolved oxygen in the study area in some domestic wells that we sampled. And there's this north-south trending zone here that's outlined by this dashed yellow line. Outside that zone, most of the methane concentrations were less than the detection level of 0.0005 milligram per liter, which is indicated by the white dots. Inside that zone, however, methane concentrations were much, much larger, up to 32 milligrams per liter. That same north-south trending zone also had very low DO concentrations. The red dots indicate DO less than half a milligram per liter. Outside that zone, though, DO concentrations were greater than half a milligram per liter, and in most cases, greater than 2 milligrams per liter. So we started to wonder, well, why are you seeing this low DO, high methane zone in this very specific geographic region? And so we sampled for a number of other constituents, including helium-4, a noble gas, and it turned out that north-south trending zone is also a zone of high helium-4 concentrations, with concentrations upward of 1,000 times greater than what you'd expect from air-water equilibrium. So there's a lot of helium in this water in that particular zone. So this plot on the left shows depth of the well screen below the water table on the y-axis and helium-4 concentration on the x-axis. And then these lines show different helium-4 concentration gradients. So low concentration gradients here and the gradients becoming higher as you go to these lines. And all of the samples outside that north-south trending zone plot along this low helium-4 concentration gradient line, whereas all the samples within that north-south trending zone plot on lines indicating much higher helium concentration gradients. There's two sources of helium-4 in the subsurface. One is from the decay of uranium and thorium within the aquifer itself, and the other source is from upward fluxes from deeper sources. All of the samples outside that north-south trending zone, the helium in those samples anyway, can be accounted for by in-situ production based on the measurements of the amount of helium and thorium in those sediments. However, the samples within that north-south trending zone have to have that additional source of helium to account for their concentrations, that upward flux from deeper zones. So it appears that anoxic methanogenic water from deeper sources is mixing with young oxic water in that north-south trending zone. And there is a lot of geologic structure in that area, in particular this Divide Creek anticline. I can't quite see from this angle where it is there. That is an area where there's a lot of fracturing and faulting, and the Wasatch Formation is thinned out considerably. So gas-producing interval that energy companies is targeting is much closer to land surface there. To conclude, I'm sure you guys already knew this, but if you didn't, hopefully I convinced you that redox is an important explanatory variable for understanding the occurrence and distribution of contaminants in groundwater. Redox characterizations are also provide us with information about the flow system. That's an important thing for us to remember, I think. The most robust redox frameworks would consider spatial and temporal patterns in electron acceptor consumption and end product production, as well as intermediate product concentration. So all three parts of the equation, basically. It's best to consider those. What do I say here? I say if you don't measure any other redox constituent, at least measure dissolved oxygen. It's easy to do. It's cheap. You're in the field already. As Mindy told me yesterday, she put it well. She said, the expensive part is just getting out there. So that's all I have. Thanks for your attention. That's a good point that you made. It's easy to measure DO. It's not so easy to collect a good sample. and domestic wells, it can be hard to get good samples, for example. I mean, you want to collect before pressure tanks and that sort of thing. And you want to collect your sample without exposure to atmosphere. I mean, it depends on the method you're using, whether you're using a meter or a chemical method. We use all of them. For low DO waters, we usually rely more on chemical methods like Winkler or Chemet's kits rather than meters. But it's crucial to remember that it's harder to collect a good sample than it is to make the measurement. There are some studies that have looked at that, and one of the better studies was done up at Princeton, Minnesota, at the MESA site there. It was a paper by Bolke et al. And Water Resources Research in 2002, where they measured the amount of electron donor in the sediment, they measured the rate of denitrification, and they calculated how long that donor supply would last. And I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head, but that's a great place to go look at an example of how that was done. Thanks for your attention.